And I thought there were a number of different things that would be worth discussing today. One of them is anything more that has occurred to you about the cases you looked at, and then a number of points that occurred to me that I wanted to raise about some of the cases. Then I wanted to go on to talk a bit about the paper of mine from China to cyberspace and the set of issues that it raises, some of which get discussed in the chapter on China that you've now read, and finally anything that you wanted to discuss about the chapter on China. So let me start. Instead of asking for comments from you on everything this time, I'm going to divide all comments in three parts the way Caesar did Gaul. And let's start by asking whether you had things you wanted to discuss about the cases that you now read for yourself.
About those cases?
Not the chapter yet. As I say, I decided that there were really three different subjects that I wanted to talk about, and it would be easier to separate them. Yeah? No. All right. Well, a number of the cases that struck me, one of them is this whole issue of forgiving people who turn themselves in. Because sort of from, at least from an economist standpoint, it's sort of a neat case of a tension between incentives on two margins. That on the one hand, you want to make it easy to catch people who committed crimes, and it's really easy if they turn themselves in, so you want to reward them for turning themselves in. On the other hand, if you reward them too much for turning themselves in, then there's no cost to committing a crime and then surrendering, as long as you surrender fast enough so that the crime hasn't yet reached the notice of the authorities. So it's really a... And that's a pattern, that's sort of an interesting pattern that shows up in a lot of other cases. See, my favorite example, which I usually discuss in my law and econ class, is whether or not contracts made under duress ought to be enforceable. We sort of take it for granted that they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And we then say, well, why shouldn't they be? And I say, well, look, let's suppose the mugger comes to you and he says, $100 or I kill you. And you answer, will you take a check? Because you don't have $100 on you. If the legal rule is you can now stop payment because it was made under duress, and he knows that, he won't accept the check and you get killed. You'd much rather pay him $100 than get killed. So at one margin, at the margin of what happens when he makes this demand, it looks like making it enforceable is a good thing. On the other hand, the knowledge that such a contract is enforceable makes mugging much more profitable because people have more money in their checking accounts than they do in their wallets. So therefore, you're trading off less damage per mugging against more money. And to take a case where it seems to me it's a much less clear what the right answer, I think that one's pretty clear what the right answer is. But let me take a much less clear case, and one which is important in the real world. And that is you have a military dictator who is in a position to stay dictator, but would rather not. From his standpoint, he took over because of some emergency situation. Everything is now clean. The bad guys have been killed or locked up. The people he regards as, that's the case I was thinking of, sure. And so he says to the opposition, look, I'll make a deal. You agree to immunize me and my people for prosecution against anything we did while we were in power, and we'll turn over the government to you. If that deal, that looks like a contract made under duress, right? And yet if that deal is not enforceable, then he never turns over the government, and you have the story of Franco or Stalin who basically stays in power until he dies. And in this particular case, they made that deal, and then a Spanish judge attempted, I think it was a complicated case, but basically a Spanish judge said, look, among the bad things you did, they were killing some Spanish citizens, so we have a claim against you, and we will therefore break the deal that you made with the Chilean authorities. And I think at that point, Pinochet was fairly sick and was in England, and there was extensive litigation, not all of which I followed. But it just struck me as an inherently interesting example of the same problem, that on the one hand, making such deals enforceable means that while the dictator is in power, he has less incentive to restrain himself. But if you assume that in the typical case, even a restrained dictator, given that he's choosing to be a dictator, is going to do things which will be seen as illegal after he's out of power, you say, well, it doesn't really matter whether... If you aren't going to be able to get him to turn over the country to a democratic government, even if he's restrained, unless the contract is enforceable. And then the argument is that terminating the dictatorship is worth, in a sense, is being not being very restrained. If you're putting it differently, even without the deal, he's going to have to kill a certain number of people. It's not clear he's going to kill very many more with it. So let me go on to one more example of the same thing. And my other example is a historical one, and that's the institution of parole as it actually developed in military affairs in Europe. I don't know how much you know about this. But prior to about the Napoleonic War, it was quite common that if you were taken prisoner, especially if you were an officer, sort of an upper-class type, by the enemy, say you're an Englishman fighting in France a little before Napoleon, you get taken prisoner by the French, and a French officer comes to you and says, Monsieur, the jail is over there. It's not a very nice jail, but we can lock you up as a prisoner in the jail if you wish. On the other hand, the inn is a very nice inn, and Madame is a fine cook. If you will give me your word, parole is French for word, that you won't try to escape, assuming you can afford the inn, you can stay at the inn. And how is that system enforced? It's enforced in part by the fact that if he does violate his parole and the people back home find out about it, they will conclude that he's not a gentleman, that he has behaved badly. So there were serious social sanctions enforcing that rule. And on the face of it, it looks like a good rule, right? It means that the cost of warfare is less. But, of course, the same argument goes through. The cost of warfare is less, so people will be more willing to engage in warfare. So there's, again, the same pair of margins between reducing the cost of something undesirable and increasing the amount of something undesirable. Now you want to say something.
Yeah, in the case of the hypothetical dictator offering a deal to the political forces that are opposed to them, it's not really that they're under duress, any additional duress on making the deal. In other words, he's in control of the country, and he's saying, in exchange for future behavior from X, I'm willing to step down. But it's not like their condition is marginally different between when he offered the deal before when he offered
it. That's true. On the other hand, from their standpoint, his power is illegitimate. And therefore his threat is, I will continue to oppress the country, I will continue to rule without democratic sanction unless you do this. If you want a case where it's even clearer, think about peace treaties. All right? It's hard to think of more duress than dropping bombs on people. And yet we have some feeling that it's a good thing for the world if once a country is surrendered, it stays surrendered. As opposed to a world where you know that if they surrender and you don't immediately, you know, lock up all the soldiers and seize all the weapons and everything else, as soon as you've taken your army back home, boom, they'll start the war again. That seems to be an unpleasant situation. So anyway, it just struck me that it's an issue that shows up in a lot of different places. It's a logically interesting pattern, and therefore it's useful to be familiar with, to have thought about it. And as I say, it seems to me that the Chinese, who are thinking about this question of to what degree you pardon people who turn themselves in, are facing the same thing.
That's a question. Without legal rule, essentially make all victims into like repeat players. So
victims or?
Yeah, victims. So
not when they're dead.
In the holdup situation, you're held up by a gunman.
Yes.
Since you're a one-time player, you have the incentive to renege the deal.
That's right.
But that rule would make you into essentially a repeat player.
It would be the same effect as being a repeat player, since it would then be enforceable. You don't have to be a repeat player if contracts are enforceable. So it's part of the point of making contracts. In a sense, in a world where all interactions were long-term repeat player interactions, it's not really you even need courts to enforce contracts.
Right.
And then, so you can think of the court as a substitute for that situation. The... All right, another point that struck me, just looking over my sort of list of things, of interesting cases, which I thought five pages of the list of, is the degree to which the Chinese law is a system of enforcing rules rather than judging the morality of behavior, if that makes sense. That there are a whole bunch of cases. For example, a clerk fails to properly stamp a document which is going into the file. It's never going to be issued. And he gets, I don't remember, 80 blows of the heavy bamboo or something. I don't remember if he doesn't stamp it at all or stamps it upside down, but that kind of mistake. We've got that story where a district magistrate, a fairly important person, gets carried into the temple in the rainstorm. It doesn't feel like it's his fault. He loses his important position and gets punished in addition to that. We have this rule that if you kill two people in one family, That's a terrible crime, more or less whatever the reason. I think one of the cases we looked at, the people in question were the attackers, the ones who got killed. One of them had just killed the father of the guy who killed him, which you would think in their system is about as strong an excuse for killing them as you can imagine, but still killing two people or three people from the same family counts as a very serious offense. Again, there are a number of different cases where the court is spending time and effort figuring out what the right criminal punishment is to sentence a corpse to. All right? The defendant has died, and they still have to figure out what, where in the system of statutes he fits and what the proper penalty was that he should have been imposed on him if he hadn't died. So a lot of it looks... I don't know if the underlying idea is that virtue consists of following the rules. That certainly if you think about people's moral intuitions, there's a real conflict between the intuition which says it's the rule, therefore you should do it, and the intuition which says you should do good things and not do bad things. So if you think about, let me take the case, you're on a jury, and the person is charged with something you don't think should be illegal, smoking marijuana, and you're in favor of marijuana legalization. Is the moral thing to do to say, well, it shouldn't be illegal, but it is illegal, I'm on this jury, my job is not to judge the law, but to judge the facts, therefore I've got to vote for conviction, he's guilty. Or is the moral thing to do to say, no, I shouldn't play a part in punishing somebody for something he had a person's right to do? Right, those are two different intuitions, both of which exist in our heads, both of which you can see. I was actually thinking about it most recently because I was in the situation a year or two ago where I got jury summons. The defendant was charged, if I remember correctly, with concealed carry of a firearm. It is entirely possible that he had good reasons to, given the context. A ex-student of mine was the central figure in setting off the sort of national debate on whether it should be legal to carry firearms concealed, because he co-authored an article on that subject, which got a lot of attention. That article was making a point that I made in a textbook, although he was using empirical evidence and I was just sketching the theoretical argument. So it was an issue I cared about and where I thought clearly that what the guy did shouldn't have been illegal. So the judge asks me, if you disagree with the law, are you willing to rule in favor of it? And I said no. Now, that may have been partly a selfish decision. I didn't really want to spend time on a jury. But I was wondering if it was an immoral decision, if what I should have done was to say yes and then voted to acquit. All right, what's the right answer to that? Right, is my obligation to tell the truth to the judge, or is my obligation to keep somebody from going to jail for something he shouldn't go to jail? I'll let you think about it, because I don't know the answer to that question. Yeah.
I don't know what the morality of it would be. But I know that there are implicit laws that impact question of a very similar question. What is legal and what is the law actually?
Yeah.
And from part, I remember he thought what the law actually is where morality, positive morality, and what's written on the book actually intersect. And morality and law actually play a dialectic with one another. And actually develop
one another. But that sort of doesn't answer if at this point they haven't yet become congruent, which
right.
You obey.
Right.
So all I'm saying is that you can think of a lot of the features of the Chinese law look as though they're very far on one side of that particular tension. But it's a tension, a different version really of the same logical tension, not the same moral tension, is the issue in a legal system between what are referred to as rules or standards. So consider the question of who can be elected president. And the rule is somebody's got to be at least 35. Now that's clearly the wrong rule. All right? You know 30 people who are 35 or over who are less mature than people who are under 35. You may even be able to think of someone who's been elected president who you think are less mature than people under 35. On the other hand, at the moment, what our health care law is up to the Supreme Court, and if the rule were the right rule, which is must have the maturity of the average 35-year-old or something like that, then who's president is up to the Supreme Court too, because there isn't any objective rule there. So in a lot of cases, you've got to decide, should the law go by easily testable but not quite right things like physical age, or should it go by harder to measure but more nearly correct things? in some of them. Negligence is probably more standard than a rule, whereas age to be elected president, or age to vote, or age to drink are all rules rather than standards. So again, it just struck me there were a bunch of interesting general issues that were raised by what feels to me at least like somewhat bizarre features in this particular case. Yeah.
This is a minor note, but during the reign of the first Ming emperor, there was a terrible controversy when it was discovered that some officials were actually sending orders on without monitoring to see whether or not what they were sending on was in fact correct. They were simply following long-established procedure, but because the long-established procedure to skip the official rules and just say you've got a rule, okay, you've got an order, come in, you just tap it and send it on. But the official rule was you actually have to get a countersigned by your contemporary and right up. And when the Ming Emperor found out that these people weren't actually following the rules, 10,000 officials were executed. And, you know, people are saying, we've been doing this for years. You're now going to have us killed because we're not actually following the rules. But no, the rules are rules. You're not following them, and you'll be killed instead.
Yeah.
This is not endearing to the Confucian bureaucracy.
Yeah, no, you can see that it might not. Another point that struck me just sort of looking through the cases is what I was thinking of is sort of their equivalent of our canons of construction, which is, given that you've got this system of statutes whose purpose is to define penalties, basically, not to say what's wrong, and given that it never fits everything, how do you figure out what the penalty is when it doesn't fit? And while it's clear, as I was discussing before, they have a good deal of flexibility if they want to exercise it, at the same time, there pretty clearly is a sort of almost mechanical process in which you can say, well, look, what are the offenses this is similar to? Is this more or less serious than each of them? We don't want a punishment, want a penalty which either is more severe than the penalty for an analogous crime that's less serious, sorry, that's more serious, or less severe the other way. And you can sort of see them engaging in what looks almost like a mathematical process of thinking about the different things that might be seen as in order to find the right punishment. Of course, this is easier when your punishment choices are not continuous. You can't say, 11 days, 12 days, 13 days in jail is either a year or 2 years or 3 years exile. I know that was interesting. Another, yep. They're accused of the crime, and there is a trial in which they are interrogated and possibly tortured, and in which other witnesses are interrogated and possibly, though much less likely, tortured, and eventually the magistrate makes a decision.
Okay. So it's torture.
It's arguably guilty until proven innocent.
But it's pretty much probably always guilty.
No, I don't think so, because first, I don't think they're always tortured. No, my guess is that if the magistrate really concludes you're innocent, he would acquit you. It's just that there isn't a presumption of innocence as far as you can tell. And if he tortures you and you die under torture and you were innocent and you turn out to have been innocent, then he's in very serious trouble. So, at least in theory, yes, in practice, at least if it comes to the ears of the higher up people, if the censor shows up or something. But of course, the cases we're reading are not cases of first impression. The cases we're reading are really like our appeals court cases. And our appeals courts, after all, aren't normally figuring out whether somebody's guilty either. The difference is that our appeals court are more or less figuring out, did the lower court get the law right? Did they give the defendant the rights he was entitled to? Was there some kind of a error in how the case was handled, as it were? Whereas what these people are deciding, which in a sense is analogous but not the same, is did they get the sentence right? All right, they almost never. There are very, very few cases where they question the facts. There are a couple of them where they say, all right, the lower court accepted for gospel what so-and-so said, but so-and-so had an incentive to say it whether or not it was true. They ought to have investigated it further. Those are occasionally, but mostly they accept the lower court's facts, and the real question is where does this fit into the legal system in terms of figuring out the proper penalty.
Well, then how would they be torturing if they're not trying to...
But that's the appeals court.
But why
the torturing is at the court of first impression, where they're trying to figure out what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the Judge D books is partly about this, because it's and the interesting thing, of course, is that D is the one who's choosing to torture the defendant. He's the good guy in terms of the book. And what's going on is you've got a woman who's killed her husband. She has cleverly killed him in a way that's very hard to detect. and she's a tough lady, and she's playing a game of chicken with the judge. She's basically saying, I can hold out until you kill me, and if you kill me without having evidence that I'm guilty, you're going to be in real trouble, so you better back down and let me loose. And what ends up happening, which is sort of neat, is that another woman tells the judge how the murder was committed. But the reason she knows is that she killed somebody that way too. And she is a sufficiently virtuous person. She realizes the judge will figure this out and she'll end up also being convicted. But she tells him anyway. And so it's a neat story in that sense. If you want to kill your husband, the method involved is driving a needle of some sort into his skull, into his brain. I don't know if you do it in the right place, at least according to the novel. Unless somebody is looking for that, they're not going to find it. So that's one of them. But I thought it was sort of neat that, because we take it for granted that torturing people is obviously something that only bad people do. And here it's the virtuous judge who has correctly figured out who did it, and he just has to make her tell, and make her confess.
To go into the criminal system in China, the magistrates at the level that they interact directly with people have enormous power. The curves on them is that they get rotated around every 3 years. They get ranked every 3 years. All the good and bad things that they've done are assessed in the Ministry of Personnel of Beijing, or whatever the capital is. And all the people who have written and complained about them gets added up and said there are 15 complaints against you and only two letters of praise, you're obviously a terrible magistrate. Or, and the other thing that they have, so they get ranked, and if they're sufficiently bad, they get booted out, or worse, they get sent down to the southern malaria zones where they're almost certainly going to die from malaria. So there are really downsides to doing a bad job. And the other thing that you have to worry about as a magistrate is that they have the imperial monitors, you call them censors, who travel around, sometimes incognito, but they're armed with the imperial seal. There are 100 censors that travel throughout China. There are 15 assigned to every province, so there are 150. They travel around to China, and they literally set up shop, and they say, who has complaints about the magistrate? They come to each individual town. They have their old register, their old route. They say, who has complaints about the magistrate? Come forward and let me hear them. And he has the power to literally say, I have 15 townspeople complaining about you. I have the power of the emperor. I'm putting you in jail. I'm sending you to Beijing to be judged again. So even though the magistrates have enormous personal power, they have real incentives not to abuse it, because they can lose their jobs, they can lose their status, they can be judged badly and not be promoted.
On the other hand, it looks as though the formal appeal system up the court system is one which is heavily discouraged. There was this doctor case, I was looking at it again, and the facts of the case are that the doctor prescribes what the court eventually agrees is the wrong treatment, which involves some form of acupuncture. I don't remember the details. The patient dies. I think it's the patient's father who complains. The lower level court dismisses the case. They say there's nothing wrong. The father ends up complaining, I'm not sure if it's to the provincial or all the way to Peking. Eventually the higher level court takes the case, concludes that the doctor is at fault, sentences the doctor to strangulation after the assizes, then converts that into a money fine of about 5.5 ounces of silver, and sentences the father who complained on the grounds that his complaints embellished the facts to 100 blows of heavy bamboo. That is not an encouragement. Maybe if the father feels strong enough, he wouldn't put up with that, but it's not an encouragement to complain. I was looking at a number of other figures. I was thinking in terms of my impression that these monetary compoundings were really slaps on the wrist of comparisons. And the highest such compounding is about 5.5 ounces. The highest payment for funeral expenses if you kill somebody wrongfully is 20 ounces, 4 times as much. In order for theft to be a capital offense, you must 3 times be convicted of having stolen more than 50 ounces. So I think that sort of gives you some scale. It's one of the things that's worth doing in all of these cases where they've got money, to try to figure out if you can find in some way a scale that will judge how much things are. And I think I have a note somewhere suggesting that laborers were getting a bit less than an ounce a day for a full-time employment. I'm not sure if that's right, but that was a note that I didn't see where I got it from. But in any case.
Was there a reason it was such a small fine, or was it just
that is, there are two different questions. One of them is, why was the standard fine so small? And the other is, why do they let guys, people get away with the fine instead of 27? And as far as it looks to me as though it's a get out of jail card, as though it's a way in which the court can say, according to the rules, you're due a serious punishment, but we, for some reason, don't want to punish you, and so we'll let you off with a symbolic punishment, I think, but I don't know. You'll note in a number of cases that there's an implication in the case that the accuser is presumed guilty, too. There's this one rather weird case, I don't know if any of you read it, where the translators don't know what's going on, but it's some local official, maybe a district magistrate, who supposedly has been sucking out the vital marrow of baby girls, and 10 or 12 of them are supposed to have died as a result. This is a horrible thing over which the emperor, whoever is commenting, I'm talking about how terrible it is, and the guy who accused him, you better investigate him too to see whether he's done anything wrong. And it isn't clear whether it's a witchcraft case, where he's done nothing at all wrong, and this is just, you know, some crazy story, or if it's some kind of a real crime, maybe he's, you know, damaging infants for magical purposes or something, or what's going on. You can't tell, but it's quite clear. The other things, another one that was interesting in terms of the whole issue of how familial relations play into all of this, is that you have a father who murders his son, not because the son is disobedient, but because the father is having an adulterous affair, and the son is threatening to complain about it. Sounds like a pretty bad excuse. And indeed, the father gets punished. The father gets 60 blows plus a year's exile, or maybe a year's penal servitude, I'm not sure which. The accessory of the father, however, gets a heavier punishment than the father gets. The normal rule is the accessory to a crime gets a punishment one step below the principal. Why? Because this isn't his son, and therefore he didn't have any presumptive right to kill him. So the fact that it's father killing the son makes it sizably less serious, although still criminal, than ordinary killing would be. Now, that was sort of interesting. Yeah. Another point that struck me, and it contrasts with our practice, I'm not sure which is better, and what happens if you're guilty of multiple offenses? You attack some people and you kill one of them and you wound another. How does the Chinese do that? Anybody notice how they handle that? You only get punished for the most serious offense. Unlike ours, where you sort of, in theory, at least add up punishment. Now, of course, when we have sentences running concurrently, we're in effect doing the same thing, but that's not an automatic rule, whereas it is theirs. And if you commit multiple of the same offenses, you're only punished by one. I'm not sure what the logic of it is, but I thought it was interesting that was the rule that they had. Another case was one which struck me as something that would be obvious, I suppose, only to an economist. And that is, given that system, suppose you kill somebody. What's one obvious way, assuming you've got some resources, of avoiding the punishment? Who do you bribe to confess to the killing? No, the father. Or I guess it could be the mother, but that's less likely. Since the father will receive a much lighter punishment, and indeed if the father has any plausible cover story, he receives no punishment at all. Right? He claims the son was disobedient. So therefore, the real killer bribes the father confesses to killing his son because the son was disobedient, everyone is happy except the son who was dead. I don't remember, there was a case on page 421 or something where that's apparently happening, or I don't remember what's happening or proposed happening, but I thought it was quite neat in a sense because, again, if you think about, I think of economic analysis of law as looking at law not in terms of what ought the law to be, but given this law, how will people react? And then evaluate laws by what will happen given the law, given that rational people will take the law into account. And this is, as I say, the sort of thing I guess maybe non-economists think of too. It would seem obvious to an economist, you know, things move to their highest value use. If I can hire you to mow my lawn cheaper than I can mow my lawn, I will. Well, if I can hire you to confess to my crime cheaper than I can confess to my crime, I'll do that too. And that strikes me as really quite neat. Sort of seeing the logic of the system work out in a rather bizarre case. And I guess the one other thing that I noticed, because it was showed up in a bunch of different cases, is what looks like the paranoia of the legal system. Because you've got a bunch of cases where people do things that look absolutely trivial, and the only question is how severe should the punishment be. So you've got one person who, when he's drunk, is babbling about getting himself a fairy as a bride, or a supernatural creature out of some gulf as a bride. And, well, since he was drunk and babbling, we won't punish him too severely. I don't know what the punishment is. You know, maybe it's a year's exile or something. You've got this weird case where somebody is writing, I think, a biography of his father, and he's talking about his grandfather, too. And his father was in charge of a local granary, which I gather was not actually a governmental, but a sort of a local or town or something thing. And the father let off some poor people from owing their debts to the granary. And the son, in writing the biography, says that the father pardoned or something like that the poor people, and that's the same word that's used for an imperial amnesty. And so he is charged of, in effect, pretending his father was a claimant to the empire. Now, the father isn't even a licentiate, as far as I can tell. The licentiate is the very lowest level of the civil service, and it looks as though he's probably below that, because otherwise it would be mentioned that he was. There's just no possible, I can't see any possible way he could be a pretender to the empire. And yet the fact that he's using words in a way which could be misinterpreted that way is enough to impose some reasonably serious penalty. And in addition, he's apparently lying about the grandfather, trying to exaggerate the importance of the grandfather by saying he had a lot of books and that he had written a book. And apparently, in the course of the inquiries, he eventually confesses, probably under torture, that he made all that stuff up. But there's also evidence that it isn't true. And then there's somebody else who bought a bunch of unapproved writings, and it's not clear what they are, but it sounds like they didn't turn out to actually be, you know, subversive or magic or anything. But nonetheless, he bought them to sell them. That gets punished. So I don't know if what's going on is that you really have a system which feels as though it's sitting on a knife edge. Because certainly you do have dynasties fall, you do have successful rebellion, and of course the Manchu are originally at least foreigners, so maybe they really feel as though if we waited to punish people until they were really doing things, well then he will be really doing things, and some of those things might bring down the dynasty, so therefore we've got to punish people two steps before they're really doing anything serious. I don't know.
There's a really interesting event in Chinese history when the third of the great Manchu emperors discovers, or one of his officials discovers, a book that's written by a person who literally makes the argument that the Manchu don't deserve to be running China because they're not Chinese. And you would think that the behavior of the Manchu emperor with this would, you know, slaughter everybody, but instead he engages his character in dialogue and writes their own, he has his own imperial guys write a counter-argument to this, in which he lays out the case for Manchus have just as much right to rule China as anyone else because they fully embrace Confucian philosophy and ideals, and it doesn't matter what ethnicity you are so long as you're running things justly and correctly. And so it's a complete surprise, really. And everyone's going past and they go, oh, this emperor is so amazing and lenient and stuff. Because there are plenty of other examples in which people dare to suggest the current emperor in law the mandate of heaven. And it's like, you kill him and you kill everybody they've ever known.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's reminding me a little bit, I think I may have told you the story about Al-Mamun and the Sufi, where you've got a caliph and people who are questioning his legitimacy, and he basically responds with this account, well, you're right, I'm really not legitimate. As soon as you bring in somebody who's got the unanimous assent of all the Muslims, I'll turn over the office to him then and there. But until then, somebody's got to mind the shop, right? And at least in the story, he convinces the Sufi, like, that's a bright guy, but Al-Mamun. Al-Mamun is one of my favorite emperors, favorite caliphs that have happened. Very interesting and impressive character. But Al-Mamun is sitting on a balcony with some of his attendants over the river, I think Euphrates, I think, and he hears somebody going by saying, that Al-Mamun, do you think I care for him, a man who killed his own brother? This is the Civil War. And you know, the attendants are outraged. And Al-Mamun says, what could I do to win the esteem of that excellent gentleman? So it's in a sense the same response, but kind of impressive. When it happens, but much more often it doesn't happen. And similarly, I think I may have mentioned that Ibn Battuta discussing the Sultan of Delhi mentioned the fact that the Sultan of Delhi was willing to subject himself to ordinary law when he had done something illegal, and he accepted the verdict, basically. which again, he pretty clearly didn't have to do, and he clearly, if Batuta thinks it was an impressive thing that he was willing to let the young man who he had slapped in, basically, which is what the verdict amounted to. All right, I think that covers my cases things that I wanted to talk about. So if you have no more comments on that subject, the next issue is the stuff covered in the China to Cyberspace paper and in the chapter on Taiwanese law that you read, and also discussed a bit in the chapter of my book, my book draft that you've read. So feel free, by the way, to make any suggestions you would like about that draft. I'm always in favor of having free labor from other people to help me write my books. One of the things I've been doing of late is when preparing for class, I read through the chapter and I make corrections and additions and such while I'm doing so for the next round of doing it. So anyways, let's take the question, the China to cyberspace stuff, which is really the general issue is how you manage the process of contracting when you don't have courts that are willing or able to enforce contracts. That's the general puzzle, which I'm claiming is of interest for a bunch of different reasons, including Chinese law and cyberspace law. So were there points that occurred to any of you? Yeah.
When you talk about the matter of the fact that contract law, how contract practices really enforce the reputation and things like that, I was wondering whether in China or Taiwan or elsewhere in the world where we have a similar situation, to what extent does arguments not play a role in the contract enforcement?
I think the answer is that in Sicily it did. There's a this book on the mafia, which it sounds to me as though that was probably one of the services they were selling. But the general impression one got from the book, the Gambetta book on the mafia, is that most of what they were doing was, in fact, arguably desirable stuff, substituting for the lack of an effective government. They did a certain amount of extortion as well. They didn't limit themselves to the charge of the government to extortion. It's called taxation. But a lot of what they're doing is basically saying, all right, if somebody robs your store, we don't need courts. We'll figure out who it is and beat them up. And that sort of stuff.
I used to live in Taiwan. When I was there, I read an article that argued that Taiwan is essentially they call something like a low-trust society. People don't trust each other. So I think the reputation enforcement that we were claiming actually is true. I did experience a great deal of fraud in contrast, and it didn't seem to be that
but that to begin with, this is 80 or so, or 90, no, more than 100 years after the period being described at this point, so things might have changed. But also, I wonder if there's a distinction between outsiders and insiders, in the sense you can easily enough have a system where the people who identify each other as sort of being part of the system and knowing each other and how people will talk to them, trust each other at the same time that the rest of the world is fair game. What was your situation? Do you speak Chinese?
But for example, one thing was I knew a lot of restaurant owners.
Yes.
And at first I thought I made that exact connection. The foreigners who were running restaurants physically complained that when they would start a deal with a distributor, you know, if it was me, the first shipment of steaks was really good. Each time it got, the quality went down, and they keep getting cheated on the target. So they changed to another distributor. And they had the same situation over and over again. I thought, well, maybe it's because they're foreigners. I talked to, you know, Taiwanese people about it.
And they said the same
thing.
So that's the story I've heard about India, that if you buy things like lentils, that once they've got you as a customer, they start adding stones and such, which increase the weight. No cost. And so the question is, the very interesting and important question is, what are the conditions in which that is or isn't equilibrium? There's an old book by Ed Banfield, who was a fairly prominent political scientist at Harvard, called The Moral Basis of a Backward Society. And he was comparing two towns he had lived in, I think, one of them in Italy and one of them in the U.S. And he was arguing that each of them was in a stable equilibrium. And the Italian equilibrium was a no-trust equilibrium, in which if you did trust people, you got cheated, so it was a foolish thing to do. The U.S. one was a trust equilibrium, in which failing to trust people meant you lost lots of opportunities, and cheating people meant that people stopped dealing with you because there were lots of honest people around. And so he was sort of seeing it for the game theory type people as sort of a Nash, multiple Nash equilibrium situation. I don't remember. I read this book a long, long time ago. So I don't remember whether he had suggestions about how you could flip it, how you could change from the one equilibrium to another. But you would certainly imagine a society could.
Apparently, the article that I read did make the argument that the mafia played the role of contract enforcement in Taiwan.
It wouldn't have been the mafia, but...
Which makes the black, I think we call it black gold.
So why didn't you avail yourself of their services?
Why didn't I avail myself?
Yeah, right. Why?
I didn't have lunch here with them, so... Right. You know, and they weren't interested in...
So what were you doing in Taiwan?
I was working in studying Chinese.
I see. Yeah. But the work wasn't, you weren't actually engaged in buying meat or anything equivalent to...
I had friends who started restaurants there,
yeah.
And they kept complaining about this.
Yeah.
And I thought it was maybe because I said, why don't you just have a Chinese person negotiate for you?
Yeah.
And when I talked to Chinese people, we said, well, that's just how it's done here. I learned some really interesting stories, like when Hong Kong, in Singapore, I knew someone who was involved when McDonald's opened up in Singapore, and they had to eventually ship their bed that they put the food in from Australia, because they kept getting cheated on the bed.
Hmm.
And all they wanted was to get, we pay for, 10,000 bags, we want 10,000 bags of a certain quality, and no matter who they went to, they kept getting cheated. The quality would go down, and the number would keep going down. They eventually have to ship it over from Australia, from another country, and pay import taxes to have a bag to put the food in.
Yeah.
It was just a very common thing.
Yeah. Well, if anybody has a good theory of why you get either the perverse or the desirable equilibrium in different societies, that would be interesting. And if you come across one, tell me. It's an interesting question. But it would be even more interesting if it actually exists in Taiwan.
Right.
But anyway. But see, it wouldn't have to be being Chinese. It might be being a merchant, being a member of a merchant association. You could imagine various... Because I've seen the argument that one of the very common patterns you observe here as elsewhere is a particular industry being dominated by an ethnic group. So it was Orthodox Jews in the diamond business. I forget who it was who ran all the donut shops in Los Angeles, but it was some not obvious ethnicity, I remember, and I remember the other thing. As far as I can tell, motels in America are an Indian monopoly. I exaggerate a little bit, but an awful large fraction of motels in places not in major cities where you'd say, there's nobody from India for 100 miles, and sure enough, the face behind the counter is Indian. And in some of the, there may be lots of reasons, but some of these may be cases where within the ethnicity, you've got pretty good mechanisms for enforcing trust, and therefore people in the industry get a real advantage to being a member of whatever the ethnicity is of the common industry.
Yeah, I have a question. When you have something that depends on reputation, or a reputational reputation system, how do you allow one-time players or new players to enter?
By putting the burden of trust on the other person. The one-time player pays in advance.
Okay.
Any other? Yeah.
When you talk about merchant who accepted delivery goods and their vehicles, it turned out to be defective. I'm trying to understand how this system works when you don't have any kind of recourse like that.
You inspect the goods. You inspect the goods before you accept them. Or you deal with somebody you think you can trust, but the point is that a lot of the logic of that system is that wherever possible you let the costs lie where they fall, because you don't want to have to involve a court. And that's sort of the basic logic of this. I'm going to recording again, so that ought to get me my more than an hour recording. Of course, they may have improved it, maybe it does more than an hour now, but yeah. Let me. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I was going to sort of make a number of general comments about this thing. That to begin with, in this course, it's really coming in terms of the context of Chinese law. The cyberspace is the other place that intrigued me about it because of the degree to which it's hard to use a system of sort of national courts and laws and such in a international network where even fairly, I mean, obviously you have lots of international trade, but most international trade is being done by firms large enough to afford lawyers, whereas an awful lot of stuff on the internet is very small scale individual things. And in addition, the internet has technologies which make it possible to deal with people without really knowing who they are. And that's something I've written about elsewhere at some length, that it turns out that the combination, that basically the internet plus the things that are made possible by public key encryption mean that you can have a reputation and anonymity at the same time. You can prove that you're the same online person through a series of transactions, but if the transactions are doing something illegal or something that people that would get you taxed in your home country or would get you in trouble in some other ways, you can choose to keep your actual identity secret. Yeah.
And
if you
have to digest your answer, you've been shifting the burden sure. onto the person who has a reputation.
Yeah.
But then don't they have an incentive then to cheat the one-time
lawyer? That depends on whether he is in a position to damage their reputation. That is, well, he may be. For example, that one, it's complicated. That one of the points that I think I make there, certainly made elsewhere, is that reputational enforcement depends on low costs to third parties figuring out who cheated. And that one of the ways you make reputational enforcement work is by lowering those costs. So one way of doing that is that you have sort of standard terms of trade. Everybody knows that the normal rules for this transaction are X. If we can see that you broke those rules, then we can be pretty sure that you're the bad guy. Another way is the use of the chop, the signature, the seal, which shows that it was really signed by you, or thumbprint, I guess, would be an equivalent version, sort of lower tech version of that. But another way is things like saying, it doesn't count as cheating if the stuff was of low quality because there's no implicit guarantee of quality. It was up to the buyer to inspect it. Until the buyer accepts it, it's sitting in the seller's warehouse. It's the property of the seller. The seller hasn't gotten his money. Once the buyer has inspected it, the seller has no obligation with regard to quality anymore. So if you set up your rules so that if people do cheat on those fairly simple rules, it would be reasonably obvious, that makes it easier for even the one-time player to engage in reputation. Now, in addition, the repeat player may want to establish a reputation with the one-time player because the one-time player might become more than a one-player player later on. So there's some incentives to do that as well.
So the strength of the criticism of the one-time player really doesn't hold very much weight, right? Because he himself has no reputation.
Unless that depends on whether his criticism itself depends on his reputation. Right? The reputation is the reputation of not cheating people in transactions. But my incentive to accuse you of cheating if a one-time player is a lot less than my incentive to cheat you. So I don't end up talking to anything if I accuse you of cheating. And people may, after all, say, well, you know, he's the complainer. He's the guy we don't want to deal with. So if I tend to reverse your situation. I tend to say, if I can't prove that you, the repeat player, cheated me, I'm never going to complain at all. Because the complaining will only hurt me, because people who listen to it will say, well, look, one of them cheated. We don't know which. Let's be less willing to trust both of them. And that therefore, for the reputational method to work, it has to be a situation where there are ways in which other people can figure out which of us cheated, and there are a number of possible such ways. One of the ways is to make the terms of the contract simple enough so that cheating is pretty easy to observe. And you know, if as soon as I've received my gold bars, I scratch them and it turns out they're lead, and I then call in all the bison and say, look, you know, talk to this guy. He's the porter who just brought me the gold bars that I paid for. Look at these gold bars. That's pretty obvious. Whereas if what I say is, well, this grain isn't as good as I thought it was, well, you should have looked at it before you paid the guy. And that's a way of doing it. At the same time, I also argue that arbitration is a mechanism for lowering costs to third parties. That if we have trusted arbitrators with a reputation, then if I, the one-time player, agree with you in advance that any dispute will be settled by him who's a trusted arbitrator, and we both stamped our seals on that agreement, now you don't have to trust me, you just trust him, you, the third party who's figuring out whether you cheated me. So that's another mechanism. And online, I argue, that's a mechanism that you can use using digital signatures as the online equivalent of the shop. I don't remember if I've talked about public key encryption in this class before or only in the other class. Do people have questions about the technology that underlies the cyberspace version of this story? That is, the ways in which, without ever seeing somebody, you can nonetheless make verifiable statements and claims. That basically a digital signature on a contract not only proves that I signed it, it proves it hasn't been altered, given the way the mechanics of digital signatures work. That the signature is in effect a joint product of my private key and the text of the thing that's being signed. And therefore, if the text were changed, the signature would check. So that's one of, it's better in that sense than the standard physical signature for that reason. Alright, so let me go back. The one point I wanted to make is that this discussion may be the only part of this course which is actually relevant to the job you're training to do, that is to be an attorney. Is it clear why? If you're not going to be an attorney in China, in Imperial China at least, you're pretty sure of that. And you probably aren't going to be an attorney dealing with cyberspace, although living in Silicon Valley you might. But why do I claim that in any case it's important?
Because resolving contracts is important for a commercial.
That's right.
You can structure a contract. Yeah. That's, you don't need work better.
That's at least, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that really the lawyer who keeps the client out of court is doing a good job for his client. He's betraying his profession, of course, because, you know, he's decreasing the demand for lawyers, and so your salary is going to be lower. My salary is going to be lower, right? The more lawyers there are, the more the demand for law professors. But he is nonetheless doing the job he's been hired to do, because courts are not expensive, they get you bad publicity, they tie up your time and effort, the result is uncertain. So the problem of designing contracts so nobody will want to break them is a problem. It's a real world issue that you probably 20 years from now will know much more about than I do. One of the things, many of you, those of you who are engaged in that kind of legal practice, will be involved with. So what are the ways you do it? And I guess my view is that you've got about three different methods with some complications. And the first method is, so far as possible, set things up so that if you stop at any point, property belongs to the people you want it to belong to, so that you don't have to go to court to readjust it. So that one of those rules is caveat emptor. We say that if you don't like the wheat, you inspected it before you got it, and you have no claim thereafter. So if you want to pull out at that point, you got your wheat, I got my money, no further issue. Another way of doing the same thing is, so far as possible, to unite possession with ownership, so that we make it relatively hard to have a situation where the property is in your warehouse but belongs to me. Because that's the situation, A, where I may have to sue you to get the property, and where there are obvious problems that the property gets damaged. How do we decide whose fault it is? How do I get reimbursement? And so forth. It doesn't do any good if I inspect it now, and then next week you let water in on the rain bin, on the grain bin, and it all rots. So I inspected it, but if I was foolish enough to pay for it at that point and to own it but leave it with you, then I've got a problem. So one method is to try to structure a deal as best you can so that if at any point you just stop and everybody holds what he's got, that's a satisfactory outcome. You can't do it perfectly, of course. You can do it more or less close than that. Second method is to structure the deal so far as possible so there's no point at which somebody gains by pulling out the deal by reneging. And that's where sort of my standard example that I like to use is, you're hiring somebody to build you a house. And if the deal is that you pay him in advance, you never see him again in a world where you can't enforce contracts. If the rule is that you pay him when the house is finished, when the house is finished, you say to him, you know, that house is sitting on my property. If you want to tear it down and take the stuff you used to build it, feel free. But I think we ought to renegotiate the price at this point. Because although the house is still worth just as much to me, it's worth much less to you, and somewhere between there seems like a fair price. So the way in which I believe the usual conventional way of solving that problem is some kind of progress payment. So you pay him sort of week by week or month by month for the costs incurred up to that point, and the result is that by the time you get the last payment, the amount either of you could gain by cheating the other isn't very large, and so you probably don't do it. So one issue is structuring it in that way. And the problem with that, in particular the problem when there's any real uncertainty, which in a lot of transactions there is that it's easy to lower my incentive to breach. All you have to do is I give you a deposit in advance. It's easy to lower your incentive to breach. All we have to do is have you do some performance before you get paid. But it's hard to lower our incentive. Because giving you a deposit in advance in a world without enforceable contracts lowers my incentive to breach, but raises yours. And ditto the other way around. I'm not sure whether the version that's on the web, whether the graphs are there or not. But you can sort of think about the graph of, at any given instant, what happens to each of us if we pull out. And then the problem is setting it up so that neither of those lines ever goes above the point representing what happens if we complete the contract. That's sort of the way you're trying to design it. And one thing that sort of comes out of thinking about it this way that struck me as interesting is the idea of hostages. Because if I can give you something which is valuable to me but not to you, you then don't have an incentive to confiscate it, but I have an incentive to want it back and therefore not to cheat you. So that's a way of getting, as it were, a one-sided deposit, which is sort of an interesting way of thinking about hostages. Yeah.
Or even, I don't know if you're saying they're human hostages, but equipment
nope.
Hostages, take all of their equipment. If you have
yes.
a contractor working in your house, then you keep it in your possession when they're not there.
Provided the equipment isn't of value to you. Isn't of as much value to you.
And you mean that you want to sell, you try to sell it
That's right. Then it's just a deposit. The difference between the hostage and the deposit, from my standpoint, is the differing value of the item to two different people. Now this raises a problem, just pointed out to me by my beloved daughter, when she audited either this class or maybe a different class of mine in which I raised this point, and she said, oh, you have forgotten about Ronald Coase. Because after all, even though the hostage is of no value to you, it's of value to me, so you can always offer to sell it back to me. Things, items move to their highest valued use. So if you imagine that I've given you a hostage and that you now want to break the contract, you break the contract and you say, I'll destroy the hostage unless you pay me a suitable amount to get the hostage back. So that's a problem. And one solution which occurred to me is the particular kind of hostage which only works if you violated the contract. And the example I was thinking of is either reputation or the threat to charge you, to go to the magistrate and charge you with a crime. So if you imagine that my version of a hostage now, this is in Taiwan in 1880 or something, is that I say to you, look, if you cheat me, and I can probably show you cheated me, I'm going to go to the magistrate and charge you with being a swindler. Doesn't do me any good, but it hurts you an awful lot more than it hurts me. And I can only do that if you do cheat me, because otherwise the magistrate will dismiss the case and have me flogged instead. All right. So that reputation is the same thing. One way of, it sort of occurred to me that these two different arguments here really get tied together, because you can think of the threat to report your cheating to everybody else, to publicize it, as itself a sort of a hostage. Again, it doesn't do me any good, but it does you a lot of harm. It's a way in which I can harm you. Yes, it's true on the one hand that you can try to bribe me not to. On the other hand, I can't threaten to do it. If you haven't cheated me, because you haven't cheated me, I'm not going to be able to demonstrate that you did cheat me, and therefore the threat doesn't work. So that's sort of an interesting complication where the hostage sort of interacts. And usually when I'm talking about hostages, I take the opportunity to tell one of my favorite medieval stories, which is about William Marshall. Anybody here know who William Marshall was? No. This is evidence of the poverty of our education system. This is usually the case. Fascinating character. William Marshall was, for, I suppose, a couple of decades, the top tournament knight in Western Europe. Superstar athlete. He probably regarded his younger contemporary, Richard the Lionhearted, as a talented amateur. He was born the fourth son of a minor baron, and before he died, he was regent of England. Very interesting case of sort of social mobility of a very able and talented and gifted character. However, it almost got ended almost before it began. Because when William Marshall is a child, is during the Stephen and Matilda Civil War, which again, you may or may not know about, depending on whether you've studied English history, but a couple of generations after the Norman conquest, there's a succession struggle. The King of England dies, and he, before he dies, he swears everybody he can get a hold of to support his daughter, not actually to be ruling queen, which I don't think was an option at the time, but to, in effect, hold the throne until her son could succeed. I'm not sure if the son had been born at that point yet or not. Probably he had been. And he then dies, and his nephew, Stephen, gets to London before Matilda does. Matilda is always referred to as the Empress Matilda because she had been married to the Holy Roman Emperor at one point. But he died or he no longer is at this point. And Stephen gets to England. His brother is the Archbishop of Canterbury and crowns him king. And there is then about, I think, a 14-year civil war, very unpleasant, messy civil war between the protagonists of the two sides. Gilbert Marshall, William Marshall's father, was by the standards of that civil war an unusually honorable noble, because he only changed sides once. He starts out fighting for Stephen, early on sells out to Matilda, and for the rest of the civil war, loyally serves Matilda. At one point, he is holding a castle for Matilda, and Stephen shows up in front of the castle with an army. And Stephen says, surrender or I'll siege or storm and take this castle. And Gilbert says, I got a deal for you. It's going to be a good deal of trouble for you to siege the castle. It'll tie up your army. How many people will get killed? I don't want to get killed either. The deal is that you give me 3 days. And I will send a message to Matilda asking her to bring an army and relieve the siege and save the castle. If she does, you and Matilda can fight it out. If she doesn't, I agree, I'll surrender the castle. And Stephen, who was confident that Matilda had no army within 3 days available to relieve the siege, says, sounds like a good deal, but how do I know you won't cheat me? Tell you what, I'll give you a hostage. Here's my kid, William, who's, I don't know, 8 or something at the time. You can hold him, and if I don't turn over the castle to you in 3 days, you can kill him. And Stephen says, it's a deal, and Stephen goes off and does something else with his army. And Gilbert, who, like Stephen, knows that Matilda has no army available to relieve the siege within 3 days, starts hiring mercenaries and buying supplies and getting ready for a siege. 3 days later, Stephen comes back, time up, surrender the castle. Ha-ha, fooled you. I'll kill the kid. Have I not three more? And the hammer and anvil to forge additional? And Stephen threatens to kill the boy several times, but was apparently a little too soft-hearted for the job he had at the time, and keeps backing down. At one point, he's going to throw William into the castle from a trebuchet. And William, seeing the trebuchet, starts climbing on him. He thinks it's gym equipment. And so Stephen eventually lets the boy go, suffers having been defeated in this particular interchange. And as I say, William goes on to have quite a brilliant career as a feudal warrior, soldier, nobleman.
That was the inspiration for the Knight's Tale of Chaucer.
Huh. It's before Chaucer, so it could be, but I don't know the story well enough. But anyway, so William is a lot of fun. If you ever want to read it, sort of one of the other interesting things about William, by the way, is after he was dead, some of his friends and relatives commissioned a verse biography. And the neat thing about that is that most of our written sources from that period are by clergymen. This was from the knightly class. And there's a book by a French medieval historian who argues William Marshall, Flower of Chivalry, I think is the translation, the English translation of it, and he argues that this gives us a really good source for allowing for the distortions due to the clerical reporting, that William was he was a member of the Templars, he went on crusade, he certainly was a believing Catholic, but he takes the priests a lot less seriously than they seem to take themselves. So that when he's dying, the priest says, you know, you've got to give back everything you've taken by horse from anybody. And William says, don't be absurd. I've won 97 tournaments and taken horses and armor and something. Well, no way I can give all that back. And the priest says, you know, oh, and at some point William says, you know, it just occurred to me. I've got all these clothes, rich garments, which I haven't done anything about determining what to do with them. The priest says, well, you know, you could sell them and use the money to pay for masses for your soul. And William says, don't be absurd. We're coming to the time of year when I give gifts to the young knights and squires in my household. And so I will all of my rich clothing to them as a substitute for the gift that I'm able to give them. So it's really quite a neat... Anyway, if any of you are interested in medieval history, I recommend both the biography by Painter, which is the original biography of other than the verse one of William, and the, I forget the name of the French, but anyway, William Marshall Flower of Chivalry, as a later book on the same subject. All right, I think that covers most of what I wanted to say on that. Any questions about that stuff? All right. Yeah.
I do have one comment on the relationship between the Chinese and their lack of contracts. So they developed their trading system by means of extended family members going off and living in different parts of the world, Manila, Saigon, Jakarta. And those family members would bring with them members of the family. The family that was on the coast would keep in contact with them with regular shipments, but they would be essentially the trader in residence of that particular town and engaged in doing the buying and selling for that particular thing. But they always maintained their connections back home, meaning that the people back home did want sending them, you know, women to marry, and they would send one or more children back to the original province to live and stay with the main family unit. But essentially, it's a type of a corporation.
Mm.
The extended family is operating as a type of corporation. The people at home are buying goods, shipping them off to the via their boat to their trader in Manila, to their trader in Saigon, and then that was the only deal. It was the only exchange that was made. It would go that way, and then goods would come back. But it wasn't the case that they were just sending a boat out to Saigon willing to buy and sell anything. They were only going to talk to their guy in Saigon.
But it sounds, at least from the book chapter that we read for this, is that that doesn't fully explain what was going on in Taiwan, because Taiwan, at least by their account, had a lot of long-distance trade that was not within family, clan, other such structures. Now, maybe they're wrong about that, but that was at least their conclusion. I also wanted to mention, because I mentioned it briefly, I think it was in the China to Cyberspace article, but Lloyd Cohen's article on the effects of abolishing contract enforcement in modern-day marriage. That he's got this article, I gave him the best years of my life. And it's an analysis of what happened in the U.S. when you shifted to easy divorce. And his basic argument is, and this goes back to my whole point about about avoiding situations where unilateral default is in the interest of one of the parties. So his argument is that the standard marriage pattern was one in which the wife contributed the major part of her contribution early and the husband late. Because what's the wife doing? She's bearing and bringing up children. That's a strain. It's a huge amount of work. By the time she's 40, the kids are at least in school, maybe in college, maybe off doing something. She's retired in some sense. Now she gets to play bridge. Meanwhile, the husband, in the early years, he's working his way up, developing a career, not making very much money. By the time he's 40, now he's got a secure position, he's got a good income. So with enforceable contracts, there's no problem. With unenforceable contracts, he now dumps his wife, marries a younger and sexier replacement, and profit. And that was basically the point. The first half, as it were, of Cohen's argument is to argue that that was a consequence of easy divorce.
Yeah, in modern America, 7 out of 10 divorces initiated
by women. Might be. But for a moment, to begin with, note that if you try to solve this problem by saying the person who initiates the divorce then owes money to the other one, you then have the issue which showed up in my medieval Islamic story, that the other party deliberately does a bad enough job of being a spouse so as to make somebody want to divorce them. But anyway, Lloyd Cohen has a different response. And his response is, how do sensible women respond once they realize the situation exists? They shift the timing of performance. They marry later. They space out children more, all of which happened. They have fewer children, specialize less in being so-and-so's wife, and more in their own career, which reduces the cost to them if it does break up. And so it's sort of a neat piece, and I know the author, and I've argued for a long time that his one great mistake was purely in how he phrased his argument. Because the argument was one that feminists ought to have liked, because it was describing basically men swindling women. But he made the mistake of, instead of saying, as I would have, that women perform early and men perform late in the contract, he said, women depreciate faster on the marriage market than men. And apparently a lot of women didn't like that way of describing the situation, which was pretty nearly the same statement, so various people were unhappy with him and said unkind things about what I thought was really quite a neat article. All right, so let's go on to the chapter for our last 5 minutes or so. Were there things there that struck you? Yeah.
I think two things that really struck me. The first one was I saw a common, we're talking about a common thread that went through a lot of cultures. And I was really struck by, in this culture and through many others, there seems to be a constant striking of a balance between finding right answers and efficiently finding answers. And it's just, yeah, all these systems over and over again, it really strikes me that, you know, the thing that we're going for in a legal system is not necessarily the right answer.
That's in a way also my rule versus standard point, that the rule is an easy way of getting an answer but often not the right answer,
right.
And the standard is an attempt to get the right answer but maybe hard enough so it's not doable.
My other observation was that I'm writing a paper on the mafia, and the same exact issue that you raised here I saw in the mafia, which is that sometimes it's difficult to analyze whether a particular set of behaviors is incentivized by what you can call religious beliefs,
yes,
or by economic incentives.
Yeah.
So in the mafia, like, you have all these codes or rules which are putatively stemming from honor or whatever, but in fact there's also good economic
On the subject of threads, I was thinking a few days ago, I think after this class, about a possible another chapter. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it, but the title is something like, Do All Legal Systems Fail? And the inspiration is the idea that, I'm not sure that I can make the argument for all of them, but a noticeable number of the systems we've looked at have some claimed characteristics that they don't achieve. So the Chinese system claims to be a system in which punishments are all set by statute, but as we've discussed, is very far from that. The American system claims to be a system where criminal defendants have the right to trial by jury, but in fact, something over 90% of criminal trials are settled by plea bargains, and a majority of criminal, for not only trial by jury, but trial by jury in an adversary system. And a majority of criminal cases, I think, the defendant is indigent and has an attorney who was only appointed by the state. So you can argue that we like to believe we have this sort of admirable system. What we really have is closer to an administrative system of sorting defendants into how do we punish them. The Jewish system claims to be based on Torah, but then has all of these ways of avoiding the rule of Torah when they're inconvenient. The Muslim system claims to separate state and law, but then in practice, large parts of the law get taken over by the state courts for one reason or another. And the sort of secondary element, the Muslim in theory, there are these various constraints on the caliph, all of which are eased whenever you start getting rulers who aren't actually, who don't meet your requirements, so to speak. Yes?
That is an extremely strong subcurrent in the market, which is definitely true. So, like, in the beginning, you had rule of honor which dictated that you could, or could not do certain things, like you couldn't commit violence against your brother, or you couldn't involve yourself in a drug trade. But as economic reality shifted, the rules shifted, even though the idea of honor never changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely
true. Anyway, just, I'm not sure I can actually get away with claiming that that applies to every system I've looked at. But it struck me as sort of, and you know, I could do it with a question mark at the end, you know, do all systems fail, and then say, well, here are five that do, and maybe the others don't. But it just struck me as sort of an interesting different angle to look at the ways in which there sort of tends to be a clash or a tension between the ideals of a legal system and its reality as it actually works out. Yeah?
But then you have to try and show that by following all the rules,
no, on the contrary, it might well be that the reason is that in each of these cases the rules in question don't work. Right, that would be one explanation, not the only explanation. You know, I haven't written the chapter yet, but part of what would be fun would be if you could figure out some reasonably common, some sense in which the reason they fail is always the same. And one of them might be that the nature of the problem faced by a legal system is such that there are no clean solutions to it, so to speak. I mean, that would be one possible answer. I'm not sure if it's the right answer, but I don't know if I'll write that chapter or not, but it just struck me as an interesting idea. All right. See you all next week.
Papers are due next week, right?
Correct. Drafts of papers. Drafts of papers. Correct.